This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Good to have you with us. Ahead this hour, we'll talk about the torrential downpours we've been experiencing lately in the Philly area and what local cities and towns are doing to mitigate flooding. Also, the number of complaints about child abuse and neglect has more than doubled in Delaware over the last 10 years, but there aren't enough social workers on the job to adequately investigate allegations. But first, it's early July, school's out, and there's nothing like jumping into icy, cool water on a steaming hot day. There are dozens of pools in neighborhoods throughout Philadelphia, but some of them aren't open as many hours as officials would like because there has been a lifeguard shortage. We'll talk about what the city is doing to encourage young people to think about lifeguarding as a summer job. We'll also check in to see how the renovation of outdated rec centers is going under Mayor Kenney's rebuild program, and what's the best way to handle young crowds who might want to visit during off hours. If you've got comments or questions you'd like to pass along, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Catherine Ott Lovell is Philadelphia Parks and Recreation Commissioner, and she joins us now on Radio Times. Hello, Catherine.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, thanks. So describe the situation right at the start of pool season this year and the adjustments that Parks and Recreation had to make.
Sure. The good news is that we're fully staffed now, so we have our whole complement of lifeguards or a big enough group of lifeguards to staff all of our 70 outdoor pools. So they're open full hours, 11 to 7. Our season was off to a sort of slow start because we like other major cities and municipalities around the country, have experienced some struggles and some challenges in hiring lifeguards. So to get our pool season underway, we were doing a bit of a scramble to figure out how to get as many pools open as quickly as possible.
Well, this has been a challenge.
Had a reduced schedule for the first week.
I'm sorry for jumping in. This has been something that the city and I'm guessing other cities across the country have had to deal with for the last few years. It used to be a time-honored and even an enviable summer job, lifeguarding, but not so much anymore.
Yeah, we're experiencing what we've read about sort of on a national level. I'm not quite sure which of the reasons impact us directly here in Philadelphia, but some of the things that are impacting lifeguards hiring around the country are, just more organized sports, more summer camps and sports camps and extracurriculars that kids are opting to do that are replacing traditional summer jobs. We're seeing a lack of teenagers who know how to swim or know how to swim well enough to be a lifeguard. We will train lifeguards and we'll certify lifeguards through the city, but they have to come in with a base knowledge of swimming. And unfortunately, we do see fewer kids knowing how to swim. And then lastly, what we've heard, and I'm not sure if this has impacted us directly in Philadelphia, but that, because of the clampdown on short-term working visas nationally for international folks to come over and lifeguard at amusement parks and down the shore and things like that, they've resorted to having more local kids do those jobs, which means that those kids don't need jobs, with us in Philly. So I think it's definitely a combination of all of those things.
Let's talk about the issue in which young people don't know how to swim, and many adults as well. The city is trying to remedy this, correct? With something called Swim for Life?
Yeah, we have a Swim for Life camp that we've actually expanded this summer, and that is a camp for a young adolescents to give them a really intensive experience of swimming, learning the basics of swimming, but also over competitive swimming. And it's a wonderful program that we have about 100 kids participating in this year. We also offer free swim lessons at all of our pools, and there's still other barriers that prevent people from swimming, and one of those things is that sometimes kids come to the pools and they don't have swimsuits. So we also started this summer, for the first time ever, a citywide swimwear campaign to collect swimwear for all of our pools. And it was called Suit Up for Summer, and it was incredibly successful. So we're hoping that by providing the swim lessons, the Swim for Life camp, and the swimwear, that we're really reducing as many barriers as possible to having kids learn how to swim.
And as far as making a lifeguarding job attractive to a young person, what is the pay like? And do you have to live in the city?
You don't. You actually don't. We that is one of the few positions where you can work for the city and don't have to live in the city. The pay is good. It's high. Our pay here in Philly is $13.65 for a starting salary. It can go up to $15. That's higher, much higher than the national average for lifeguards. So It's a really good job for young people. It's also a great job for recent retirees. We've seen quite a few folks who are on the sort of on the later edge of age come in and be lifeguards, and they've been fantastic. You know, recent school retirees, teachers who are retired, will come and just, you know, want to be outside in the summer, and they've been great additions to our staff.
So sure, why not?
We're welcoming anybody.
So, Catherine, what do Philadelphia's pools mean to its families? Why is it so important to keep as many pools as possible up and running?
It's so important. You know, so many cities around the country have reduced their pools. I mean, Chicago's down to like 30 pools, I think. You know, there are just, they're all moving to spray grounds instead of pools because of the expense of pools and the liability of pools. But in Philly, it's really part of the social fabric of our city and part of summer living in Philadelphia. Pools are beloved by Philadelphians. They're incredibly well used. We'll have 1 million pool visitors this summer in just the 6 weeks that the pools are open. It's just part of our summer in Philly. We've come to love them, and they're tucked into every single neighborhood in the city. Nobody has to walk more than a few blocks to get to their local pool. So it's really important and a great asset for us to have in Philly.
We're speaking with Catherine Odd Lovell, Commissioner of Philadelphia Parks and Recreation. And Catherine, let's catch up to a beloved neighborhood swim pool in Fishtown called the Swimmo. I think it's officially the Letterer Pool, but who calls it that? I don't think anybody does. It shut down a few years ago after falling into disrepair. It's not reopening this year, but it will next year. For those who aren't familiar with it, Describe the Swimmo and tell us about, you know, what it means to the Fishtown neighborhood.
Sure. The Swimmo is right on Montgomery Avenue in Fishtown. It's in the heart of Fishtown. It's across from Fishtown Rec and right next door to the Fishtown Library and right around the corner from the 26th Police District. To be honest, it looks like a giant bathtub. It's not a very big pool. You're right. Everybody calls it the Swimmo. Nobody calls it the Letterer Pool except us. It was in really bad shape. A lot of our pools throughout the city are old. Many of them are old, more than 50 years old. And the Swimmo fell into that category. It was actually leaking, and it was actually draining into the library. Mm. We had an incident for a few summers where, we would fill the pool, and then the library next door would experience flooding and damage to the library itself. So we did have to close down the Swimmo 2 summers ago, and we've been designing the new pool. There's a lot of work that goes into designing the pool and getting the construction documents ready. That's what we've been doing, and we did not have enough funding to replace it, to actually do the construction. And thanks to the Mayor's Rebuild Initiative, we announced a few months ago that we would be allocating, I think it's a little over $1 million to restore the Swimmo and get it up and running, hopefully by next summer. Yes.
So, and will it no longer look like a big bathtub?
No, it's still going to be the same size. Yeah. We have 3 different sizes of our pools in the city. You know, you have some really big pools like Kelly Pool and Longcrest and Vogue and Hunting Park. And then you have some tiny pools like Schmidt, Waterloo, and the Swimmo that are, you know, just on the smaller end, but incredibly well used and well loved by those communities. And I know in Fishtown, the Swimmo has been really missed the last few summers. There is another few local pools nearby, including Sion Pool, which is just probably less than a half a mile from the Swimmo for folks in Fishtown to use to cool off. But it'll be great to get it up and running again.
So on to the rebuild program for a minute or so. A lot of people are not happy with the soda tax, and we've heard both sides of the story, pro and con, on Radio Times. You both have their reasons. If there is one rationale for it, it is that the tax is helping to fund an overhaul of the city's recreation facilities. What is being accomplished overall, Catherine, and what still needs to be done?
Sure, it sure is. You know, the soda tax is supporting not just rebuild, but also universal pre-K for children throughout the city, as well as our community schools program. But in terms of rebuild, it's been an incredible program. It's been a lifesaver for us at Philly Parks and Rec. I honestly don't know what we would do without it. It's helping us replace roofs. It's helping us replace boilers. It's helping us rebuild swimming pools and playgrounds, but it's also helping us transform facilities all over the city, major transformations, you know, that are putting millions of dollars into sites. For instance, Vare Recreation Center in Southwest Philadelphia, we had to close that center last year because it was structurally unsafe, unsound. We were able to shore it up through some fancy engineering, so we were able to reopen it a month later, but it won't stay open much longer unless significant improvements are made. And Rebuild has helped us to allocate $11 million to the entire campus of Vare Recreation Center in Grays Ferry. So we'll be doing, restoring the building as well as the playgrounds and the fields. And that's happening throughout the city. There are currently about 60 Rebuild projects underway in some shape or form. Everything from, you know, active construction to design and community engagement. Because for some of these bigger projects, the community engagement process will take some time to not just transform sites, but reimagine what they can be so that they're really relevant to the communities today.
And quickly, is it moving fast enough for you, the process?
It is, yeah. It's really complicated. We have a one-shot chance at this, in my opinion. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to transform these civic assets. Philly is so lucky to have such an incredibly large parks and recreation system and library system. And this is a once-in-a-lifetime investment, and so we have to get it right. This can't be just, you know, a Band-Aid approach to fixing what needs to be fixed in these centers and to reimagining what they can be to the communities that they're serving. So we have to get this right, and I think the time we're taking to make sure that we get it right and make sure that all the voices are heard is really, really important. So, of course, I want everything to move faster. I've learned in city government you have to be patient, but the end result is usually really, really impactful.
Very quickly, we do have to talk briefly about a sonic device called the Mosquito. It's getting some pushback, installed in a number of Philly's parks and rec areas. It is apparently supposed to be a deterrent to rowdy groups that might visit these areas overnight. Some folks say, you know, this just assumes young people are more prone to commit crimes. It punishes non-criminal behavior. It emits a high-frequency sound that only young people can hear because us older folks are, you know, just can't hear that sort of thing. What do you say to the criticism that it's, you know, unfairly targeting young people?
Sure. So the first thing is that these devices, there's 31 of them at parks and rec centers throughout the city. They are only on overnight, so they don't go on until 10 p.m. and they're off by 6 a.m. So they're really only turned on when the park is closed to the public. They're not installed in parks or rec centers that are near residential areas, so we're very intentional in terms of placing them in a location where the range of the sound would not be heard by residents. And lastly, they're only installed at the request of community and local partners. A place where, you know, at sites where there's been a high incidence of vandalism, where sites have been, as I said, vandalized or, just different activities happening there that are detrimental to the center and to individuals there and community members.
We're out of time, unfortunately. The Mosquito will remain in place for the moment.
No, we're on a pause right now, and that's important. Okay. We are not installing any more mosquitoes right now. We are really we hear the public feedback we've received and the media coverage, and we're doing a pause on any new installations till we conduct an internal review.
Thanks so much, Catherine Ott Lovell, Commissioner of Philadelphia Parks and Recreation. Stay with us for more of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Few situations are more heartbreaking than that of the child who is being abused or neglected. And yet we are reminded by experts that this happens somewhere just about every day, and that too often social workers who are assigned to help protect these children are overwhelmed by huge caseloads and sometimes are unable to provide the relief these kids need. According to media reports, in Delaware, the number of complaints about abuse and neglect has more than doubled in the last 10 years. But despite efforts to increase the number of investigators, there are still substantially fewer on the job than required by state law. We're going to spend the next 20 minutes discussing this with Trenny Parker, Director of Delaware's Division of Family Services. Good to have you with us, Trenny.
Thank you very much.
And also Karen Drasmo runs the group Prevent Child Abuse Delaware. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Some of this will surely, you know, be difficult to hear, but let's talk about what social workers at the Division of Family Services see on a regular basis. Trenny, let's start with you.
Sure. So the Division of Family Services is the agency in Delaware that's responsible for investigating reports of child abuse and neglect. We also investigate issues related to dependency of children. So the abuse that allegations that come to us could be physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and then neglect, kind of the same thing, physical neglect and emotional neglect. And it's our obligation to conduct an investigation or an assessment with families to determine if the abuse has occurred and to the extent that it has occurred to ensure that children are going to be safe in their homes.
Karen, what sorts of cases or you know reports do you deal with that prevent child abuse Delaware?
We don't deal directly with reports. We send all of those directly to the reporting line, which is hosted by the Division of Family Services. What we are aware of are the kids who are ending up in care, particularly kids who are in foster care. We provide training for all foster families who are serving Delaware's children.
Trini, describe the procedure for investigating reports of abuse or neglect. There's a call, say, to the hotline. Then what happens?
Mm-hmm. So as mentioned, we do have the hotline.
Yeah.
So the information comes in. We create a report that is assigned to one of our regional offices. We have some response time decisions that we have to make, whether we go out immediately or we have a little bit more time based on the allegation that is made. And then from that point forward, our investigation staff conduct interviews with the child who has been reported as the victim, other children in the home, and then the individual who has been named as the perpetrator. We would also, in that point, be talking to other adults in the home, like a non-offending parent, so that we are continuously looking at what is the risk to the child in that home and what interventions need to be put in place to make sure that that child is going to be safe.
And sometimes this work can be dangerous. How do you work with families who push back against what they perceive to be interference?
So we are very fortunate in Delaware that we have wonderful relationships with the law enforcement community. So there are times where we do have law enforcement accompany us on home visits. We really try to minimize using that because obviously, having someone come to your home, whether you're an adult or a child, can be a bit of a traumatizing experience. So we try to avoid using law enforcement, except when we really feel that it's necessary to ensure that our staff are going to be, you know, safe.
Karen Durasmo, what is your group's perspective of the process?
The process is a very difficult and challenging one. The workers who are out in the field have to make very difficult decisions in very challenging circumstances. Our concern would be that the staff that are out in the field have the training and experience that they need to make the best possible decision for each family.
Well, let's talk about some of the decisions that they have to make. Give us an example of a difficult situation that a caseworker might need to make on the spot. Karen?
I can only surmise how challenging it would be to walk into a home and to find, chaotic, confused, a chaotic, confused situation that may be exacerbated by substance abuse concerns, domestic violence, people who are unrelated living in the same home. I think those are all challenges that can be faced on a daily basis.
Trini?
Yeah, I would agree with what Karen said. Probably the one of the largest decisions that our staff are faced with when they're out in the field is whether or not a child can be safely maintained in the home. If a decision is made that that can't happen, oftentimes that results in us having to take probably the largest decision we can, which is removing the child and placing the child in a foster home after we obtain a order of custody from family court. Again, going back to the trauma that brings, removing a child from their family is very difficult. So it's a decision that, you know, we don't take lightly, but ultimately our responsibility is child safety. So if we have to take that step, that is what we do.
How many investigators are supposed to be on board for the division to be fully staffed? And what is the number mandated by law, Trini?
So we actually don't have a mandate for the number of staff. Our mandate is really about the number of cases that each worker should carry. So for our investigation staff, that number is 11. And we right now are exceeding that number. We in the past have had, on average, about 100 investigators across the state. But we have been very fortunate with the support of the governor and the General Assembly and Office of Management and Budget to add positions each year to our staffing complement. For example, just at the conclusion of this last session, we were given 37 additional positions, most of which will be going to support our frontline staff. Yeah. So we are doing our very best to continue to hire new staff. Turnover has been a bit of a problem for our agency. Unfortunately, it's a problem in child welfare across the country. It's difficult work, but we are trying to do what we can to bring new staff on board.
It's difficult work. Is it compensated adequately? Is this part of the issue?
Yes, it is part of the issue. Again, we have had wonderful support from the governor and the General Assembly to raise the starting pay for our staff and to make some incremental increases as staff continue with us. But it is a lower salary than a lot of students coming right out of college really want to receive for the work that they're doing.
How do social workers not take what they see and experience home with them? And is this even possible? I mean, we're talking about a job in which the pay could be better. The hours, I'm guessing, are long. The caseloads are more than they should be. And what they might see on the job, even on a daily basis, is traumatic, obviously, for the child and family, but also for the social worker who's got to walk, wade into it.
Yeah, obviously, vicarious trauma is something that we try to focus on with our staff. We have some supportive services that are available to our staff in the event that they experience anything really that's traumatizing. So we are trying to place a focus on that, provide some additional training to help staff have some coping strategies. But yeah, some of the things that you see as a social worker, it's challenging.
Yeah. Let's bring Karen D'Erasmo back into the conversation. We've got a better phone line up now. Karen is with Prevent Child Abuse Delaware. Karen, what does your group do in this sort of situation to help, I suppose, lobby for more pay, more people on the job, and perhaps even more support services?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that is very important to us is that DFS be fully staffed with a full complement of investigative staff workers and treatment staff workers who are able to do their jobs successfully. One of the other things that we have been doing recently in partnership with the division is looking at how we can help to provide more prevention-based services and to enhance the service array that exists within our communities so that families can get support before they may need the services that are provided by the division.
Mm. Trenny Parker, who is the director of Delaware's Division of Family Services, I'd like to go back again to the situation which a social worker has to go to a family home and make the sometimes probably excruciating decision as to whether to remove a child from the home. Where does expertise, real-time expertise, a certain amount of time spent on the job, fit into this situation? Sometimes if you say there's a lot of turnover, do you find that workers aren't there long enough in the job to really be able to gain the insight needed to make some of these critical decisions?
So one of the things that happens for all of our staff when they start with us is they do go through an extensive training program. And I'll also note that our investigation and treatment staff all come to us with bachelor's degrees. That's kind of a minimum requirement for this work. One of the other things that's very crucial in providing support to our staff when they're in the field is having that person that they can reach out to, which is their supervisor. So our supervisors are always involved in those decisions. And there are people kind of in the line of sight also that can help when making those decisions. So we never want any of our staff to feel that they're on an island when making these decisions. Yeah. So that support and helping to make that call is something that's important for us to provide that support.
Yeah. If caseloads, the number of, you know, the caseload is too high for any particular social worker, do you find that children are slipping through the cracks? And in that case, how do you, what is the next step? Trenny?
So our goal, obviously, is to ensure that any report that is received at our hotline receives a response. So we are making sure that we're going out, we're meeting those initial requirements for us to make those decisions. We're checking with other individuals who have information about the family. We also have some other ways that we can connect with family beyond just the assigned worker. So we have some support positions in our agency that can go out, make sure that everything is needed for the child. Ultimately, our goal is to ensure that every child in the state of Delaware is safe. And we really work very hard to try to achieve that.
When you hear of a child that slipped through the cracks, what is your immediate reaction, Trenny Parker?
So the immediate reaction, of course, is to figure out where was that slip? What was it that happened? Was it that the hotline didn't receive a call? Was it that, you know, the family wasn't brought to our attention? Or if, you know, if the family was involved with us, we really need to take a look and figure out how is it that we can better support families? What is it that we can do? Our process is one that we are constantly looking at our practice, making sure that we're doing things the best way possible to serve the families in our state. So nothing happens in a vacuum. There's always kind of a 360 look at what is happening with our practices.
Karen Durasmo, the name of your group again is Prevent Child Abuse Delaware. What needs to happen to better prevent child abuse anywhere?
Well, in my position and from my perspective, of course, preventing child abuse would be the first and best thing that could be accomplished. Delaware is very lucky to have things like a robust home visiting program in place, which allows us to provide supports to families before anything may happen. The Division of Family Services is involved in a wonderful pilot project where they are providing services to families with substance exposed infants. Those families are receiving services before the chance for something to go wrong occurs. So I think in those ways, we've all been working together to try to get to these families and to provide them with things that may be of assistance to them, like home visiting services or parent education classes. And in cases where the family has already come to the attention of child welfare, to intensify those services so that the child is going to be safe when they return to their family.
Yeah. Trenny Parker, what are the signs that a child is being abused or neglected? And the second part of that question is it can be really hard to step in as an observer. Many of us might be hesitant. So tackle both of those first, the signs, and then why we should step in.
Sure. So, obviously for some of the reports that we receive, there are some physical signs that we can see. So if a child, sadly has marks or something of that nature, that's a little bit easier for us to look at. The other things that we look at, we really find by talking to people who are involved with the child. So reaching out and talking to the child's teacher or maybe talking to the pediatrician to find out if there have been changes in the child's behavior or other issues that have caused concern. That's one of the things that our workers do to try to do this comprehensive assessment to figure out what is happening with the family. In Delaware, one of the other resources that we have that's wonderful in working with families is the Children's Advocacy Center. So for children who have been reportedly victimized, particularly victims of sexual abuse, the Children's Advocacy Center has trained forensic interviewers that will provide an interview, which also limits the number of times that a child has to talk about a situation. Yeah. So that interview serves for law enforcement. It serves for, staff from my agency. So it minimizes the trauma of the child having to talk about the experience over and over again.
What if an observer just isn't sure? For instance, let's talk about something that might not be obvious, like sexual abuse. It might not be as obvious as a bruise on the child's face. You think something might be happening. You don't necessarily want to rock the boat if something isn't happening. What does the observer, how do you handle that situation? Trenny and then Karen?
Well, so what I will say to people anytime someone asks me this question is, when in doubt, call the hotline. I'm certainly, you know, not trying to increase the volume of calls that we receive, as we receive, you know, over 21,000 this year is I think what we're looking at. But really, if you are an individual who has some concern, let someone else help you figure out if there's validity to that concern. Our investigators will go out and assess the situation and figure out what is happening. Also, by calling our hotline, we go through a number of questions to help that reporter explain more of the details about what is happening. So after having that discussion with our hotline staff, we may find out that the concern that you have is really not one of abuse. So when in doubt, make the call.
Karen DeRasmo?
We definitely would support that position. We ask all people when we're speaking with them and they ask that question to, you know, pay attention to your gut feeling that there may be something going on in this situation that is not in the best interest of the child. Make the call. If it's not, they will, you know, if it's not something that can be investigated or that is child abuse, you know, the person on the phone will tell you that. But it's always best to be aware of what you think is going on and pay attention to that uh-oh feeling that you have.
All right. Let me give the hotline number out before we wrap up. It's 800-292-9582, 800-292-9582, and that should bring you right to Trenny Parker's office if a listener has any questions. So, Trenny Parker, thank you so much for joining us for this segment of Radio Times. Trenny is Director of Delaware's Division of Family Services.
Sure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And Karen DeRasmo is Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Delaware. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
And we'll end the hour in just a moment or so talking about our wetter climate and how cities, towns, and residents in the region can prepare for rising waters, flooding, and stormwater surge. Christopher Abrupt is Professor of Environmental Sciences at Rutgers University. He'll be along in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It seems this summer as if the threat of heavy rain is always in the air. Thunderstorms producing great big dumps of water, which overflow from gutters, storm drains, and aging pipes, flooding basements and roads, causing closures, and increasing local water pollution. One storm in late June cost three counties in South Jersey millions of dollars in public damage. And the fact is, the Delaware Valley is getting wetter. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, we've experienced an average of 54 inches of rain every year from 2009 to 2018, the wettest decade in records, dating back to 1872. So, how are cities and towns with aging infrastructures for rainwater and sewage preparing for the future? Christopher Abrupta is a professor of environmental science and an extension specialist at Rutgers University. He's taking a break from building a rain garden at the Halstead Middle School in Newton, New Jersey, as we speak, to do the interview with us. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Sure. So, what is your perspective? Are more of these heavy rain events the new normal?
Yes, definitely going to happen. I mean, what we're going to see now is we're going to see much more intense storms, and then we're going to see periods of drought between them. So, you know, we might get a heavy rainstorm on a Monday, might dump 2 or 3 inches of rain, and then we might not get any rain for a couple weeks. So that's all a result of climate change. So it actually is real. It's happening. It's happening in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and throughout your listening area. So. Yeah. It's something that we're trying to deal with right now at Rutgers and working with communities, trying to prepare them a little bit better. So when they get these heavy rainfall events, they're easier to manage and hopefully they don't flood too many people out.
Let's begin with a city like Camden, whose sewer stormwater system has been around, I think, for a couple of centuries. What happens to an aging system when we get a torrential rainfall like the one we had June 19th? I think parts of Camden County, Chris, saw 5 to 6.5 inches of rain. So tell us about stormwater runoff and water pollution there.
Yeah, so in Camden, like Philadelphia, has a combined sewer system. So both the sanitary sewer and the rainwater are combined into one piping system, and it goes to a wastewater treatment plant to get treated. So when you flush your toilet, it goes in the same pipe as when it rains, the water goes into that pipe. Now, the problem with that is when we get as little as a quarter or a half inch of rain, a lot of those systems can overflow. So you have an overflow of a mixture of rainwater and human wastewater going into the streets, into people's basements, into the Delaware River and its tributaries. So that's a huge issue. Right now, the state is working to come up with long-term control plans to try to eliminate those overflows. But even when the stormwater doesn't flow into the combined system, it's still carrying all the dirt and grime and pollution from the roadways and the things that settle out on the rooftops into our waterways, including our waterways. When we get storms like we had, 5 inches of rain over several hours, it just can't get absorbed quick enough. So the whole state turns into basically a sheet of pavement, right? Even the grassed areas can't absorb that much water that quickly. So that's the problems we're going to be seeing more and more as we move forward in the future.
Well, let's talk about some initiatives already underway. I know the Camden Smart Initiative is adding rain gardens and parks. Philadelphia's been working for years to install green infrastructure. If I'm getting from what you've just been saying, it sounds as if this is not the answer. But how much does green infrastructure help to mitigate the effect of super heavy rain events? Because I know Philly's spending, I think, tens of millions of dollars to install green infrastructure.
Yeah, so green infrastructure is part of the answer. So green infrastructure is basically a neat term for stormwater management. What it does is it's trying to build natural systems to kind of regenerate or restore the natural water cycle. So what happens when it rains, because we've paved over our surfaces and we've had all these rooftops, we get more stormwater running off the land and going into the combined system or directly into the river. So what green infrastructure tries to do is tries to install stormwater practices close to the sources of those waters and capture that water and infiltrate it back into the ground. So we create more infiltration and less runoff. A lot of these systems are natural systems, so they're using vegetation, they're landscape systems, so they can add to beautifying the neighborhood. They also help with the climate change issue, right? Because anytime we're adding plants, we're sequestering carbon, we're turning CO2 into oxygen, so that helps with other issues in urban areas. Asthma is a big issue in urban centers, so it also filters out the particulates. So there's a lot of benefits to green infrastructure, also including the ability to hire local people to install it and maintain it. So it can also be a job creator. So Philadelphia is investing a lot of money in this and they're doing a great job with that. Camden is closely behind them. We've been working with Camden Smart for several years now, helping them identify locations, where to put the practices in, and a lot of rain gardens are going in. A rain garden, very simply, is just a shallow landscape depression that's designed to intercept the stormwater and use the water at that location and get it back into the ground. So these things can be very beautiful. But like any gardening, they need to be maintained. So there's always an issue associated with that.
So back to Canberra for just a moment, Chris Abrupta. There's also the issue of really old, narrow pipes. And you mentioned clogging earlier. They clog up during a huge rain event like this. The replacement of an antiquated system has got to be costly. That's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, so there's a huge need to replace a lot of the piping system in the state, not just in Camden, but also throughout the entire Northeast. We have not invested in our infrastructure over the last 10, 15, 20 years, so we see a lot of problems like that. So when these pipes get clogged, they're not cleaned on a regular basis, that can be a big issue in causing that water to back up and cause other flooding problems. It's going to be very difficult to stop what we call the 100-year storm, which obviously does not come once every 100 years. It's kind of a probability thing. The chance of getting it this year is 1 in 100, right? So that's about 8 inches of rain over 24 hours. So when we get that kind of rainfall event, entire cities are going to be flooding out. It's not going to be something that we really can manage very effectively. But when we get 2, 3, 4 inches of rain, we should be able to manage that and certainly improve the quality of life of people. So that's a big piece of what we're trying to accomplish here with this work. And replacing those aging infrastructure is a huge issue. And it's a shame that we haven't had an infrastructure bill come out of Washington to help us with that.
And that was my next question. Is this on the radar politically? The answer, I'm guessing, is not really.
Well, it's on the radar with the governor. Governor Murphy, I know, is interested in this. It's just a finding the funding for this. I think we need some support from Washington, both in Pennsylvania and Delaware, Maryland, and New Jersey to replace some of this piping. So there just need to be some political push on that. Now, as a member of Rutgers Co-op Extension, I can't be an advocate for anything other than good science, so I can't really push politically, but you know, I can tell you the advantages and disadvantages of replacing aging infrastructure, and it's much cheaper to replace it before it breaks than waiting till it breaks. So so we see a lot of that in cities when water pipelines break and flooding out cities, it's very expensive to go in and replace that. So it's much easier to replace it before it breaks and make sure it doesn't happen.
Pays to be proactive. Well, speaking of Governor Murphy, he signed a new law in March which allows towns and counties to create storm water utilities. What does a storm water utility do?
Okay, so this is very interesting. What it does is it allows you to collect a fee based on how much stormwater you contribute to the system. So everybody has a rooftop, everybody has a driveway, so you'd be paying into a pool of money that can be used to maintain an infrastructure to support the stormwater that runs off of those areas. Now, it's a fee, not a tax. A tax you have to pay, a fee you can get out of paying. And one way of doing that is, well, if you have an impervious surface on your property, pavement or rooftop, and it's draining directly to the road into the collective stormwater system, you can stop that. You can put in a rain garden, you can put in a cistern or a rain barrel, and you can intercept that water and reduce how much is running off your property. So theoretically, your fee would go down. So what this does is allows us to collect funding either on a municipal basis or county basis, however you form your utility, to actually deal with stormwater and dedicate it to stormwater. Right now, the money to deal with stormwater issues is coming out of the general township budgets, right? So it's taking money away from fixing potholes and other repairs that need to be done in town. So it's kind of balancing that act out, you know, and trying to figure out how do we petition that money so we can fix some of our stormwater problems but still maintain the rest of our infrastructure. What this also does is it gets places like in Philadelphia, you've got a lot of parking lots, right? And those parking lots don't pay anything for stormwater runoff, you know, and same thing in Camden. So they're contributing to the problem, but they're not contributing to the solution.
Well,
so
to be fair, some
opponents an answer. You know?
Well, I was just going to say some opponents are calling it the rain tax, and it's one more tax on business. But you obviously don't see it that way.
No, a tax. It's certainly not a tax because a tax you have to pay. A fee you can get out of paying, and it's a great way to really hold people responsible. I think a big part of stormwater issue in the country is people taking personal responsibility. You know, you take personal responsibility for your roof and your house, and when it goes bad, you replace it. You know, you repave your driveway. You know, you take care of your property. Well, your property is also generating stormwater and contributing to that problem. So this requires people to take that personal responsibility so that you pay the fee or you install a practice on your property to better manage stormwater and not pay the fee. So I think that's a better way of looking at it.
All right, let me reintroduce you, Chris. Chris Abrupta is professor of environmental science at Rutgers University and an extension specialist. Let's look quickly at, you know, local towns and cities. Local budgets are often tight. Are there green infrastructure remedies that might be less costly? For instance, does it cost a lot relatively to break down a paved area that's no longer in use and then put up a park?
You know, the expenses of that can be really a wide range. So right now I'm here in Newton and we're working at a school and we have the facilities guys from the school are helping us. The town has an agreement with the school system to work with the town. So we got a guy out here in the town on the backhoe. He's digging out the rain garden. You've got a guy here in a truck from the school who's taking the soil away. So they're working together. And so the cost isn't really that expensive. So really the materials cost is what kind of chips in. So there's different ranges of practices. So like a rain garden is fairly inexpensive compared to putting in something like a porous asphalt system where you're taking out existing asphalt and putting in different asphalt that allow water to pass through it and infiltrate into the ground. So there are things you can do. What we find often is that when we go into a town, and this is what's great about the Extension Service, is that we work with communities. So you got Rutgers Cooperative Extension, you got Penn State Extension, University of Delaware, University of Maryland, both have extension services. So we go in, we work with the communities, trying to empower the communities. So a lot of what we're doing right now is trying to teach the public works guys on how to build these systems. And what we're seeing is once they start building them, they get excited about it. And not only do they want to build more, but they also maintain them more often. So now we're getting public works guys calling us up and saying, listen, we've got a flooding problem. We're thinking about putting in a rain garden. And these are guys that 2 years ago didn't even know what a rain garden was. Yeah. So now it's like a tool in a toolbox. And I think that's where we need to head. And it's a lot cheaper to build a rain garden than it is to buy concrete piping and catch basins and inlets. So it does save the town money in the long run by doing some of this green infrastructure as opposed to doing traditionally what we'd call gray infrastructure, the concrete pipes and catch basins.
Okay, Chris Abrupter, I wish we had more time because this is a really, it's a great topic. But in the final few moments that we have, let's get to some comments from our listeners. Amy tweets, I have a burning question about torrential downpours. While other towns were getting dumped on this week, I had to water my garden yesterday. What makes some spots stay dry?
Yeah, so the summer rains are very interesting because what winds up happening is you have these very small pockets of thunderstorms occurring throughout the states. And it's interesting because our state climatologist, Dave Robinson in New Jersey, he has set up a monitoring network for residents, and he's collecting data, rainfall data throughout the entire state. So you can actually see where these small pockets are occurring. And you often see this when you turn the Weather Channel on. You'll see the radar and you see these little green blotches moving across the screen. And that's just the way the weather is breaking up. The problem is that when those thunderstorms hit, we're not just getting a half inch of rain over half an hour. Now we're getting 2 or 3 inches of rain over an hour or half hour. And it's causing much more problems, that flashiness of it. And I think that's part of the issue.
Diane has a question. She asks, I've read that a problem of rain gardens is that they attract mosquitoes. Can your guest address this?
Oh, absolutely not. No, a rain garden is designed to infiltrate the water into the ground within 24 hours. You need standing water for 72 hours to breed mosquitoes. So there's probably more mosquitoes breeding in the gutters, unclean gutters and old tires and even old buckets that are laying around the yard than there are in a rain garden. So we rarely, we never see any mosquito problems with a rain garden. Rarely does it hold water more than 24 hours. It certainly drains within a day or two. So we have no mosquito problems with that.
Well, that's positive news. Chris Abrupter, we were talking just briefly about funding earlier. So as we wrap up, let's get to a group of communities which lie on or near the Delaware River in New Jersey, something called the Coastal Communities Commission. The mayor of Delran says basically Delran as an individual town wasn't really able to get the attention of state and federal lawmakers to win funding for issues like, overhauling and maintaining infrastructure. So do you think strength in numbers with a coalition like this might have eventually win attention and perhaps even funding?
Yes, I mean, we see this already. The William Penn Foundation has dumped an enormous amount of funding into the Delaware River area, and they're funding a lot of the nonprofit organizations throughout these states to work with communities. And what we find is when we put communities together, working together, and we come up with a plan, of what we're going to do. If you have a good plan and you have a good group of people who are dedicated to implementing that plan, and you also have to have some skin in the game, right? You can't expect the federal government to come or state government to come and pay for everything. You have to be willing to put some of your own resources in too. So, and those resources don't have to be money. It could simply be, loaning us the public works guys for a couple of days to help out building things and dedicating some staff resources. So that's a great way to try to get funding. And then also teaming up with people who have access to funding. I mean, we get a lot of grants for towns. We help a lot of towns write grants. And I think having that track record of being able to get the funding and actually deliver on the project is a great way to partner with groups like that. It's a great way to get money. So,
all right. Chris Abrupter, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was wonderful. And thanks for getting me out of doing all the heavy digging right now. I just have to get back.
Back to your project now, right? At the Halstead
That's
Middle
right.
School.
That's
okay.
Right. Yeah.
Chris Abrupter is professor of environmental science at Rutgers University and an extension specialist. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for the Radio Times Regional Roundup.